This podcast is supported by the growing community of artists and art lovers through the Gently Does It Patreon page. Go to patreon.com/John Dalton Gently Does It to join the conversation. I'm very happy to be talking to Ted Randler today in Washington. Ted is an artist. He paints contemporary figurative scenes made from tiny abstract marks that live somewhere between mosaic and pixels, depending on how you look at them. Ted came through art schools in the punk era of the early 80s, making big collages combining figurative painting with found objects. Then he veered into writing and illustration, which led to a highly successful publishing business. And then he returned to painting full-time 3 years ago. And just last weekend, he opened his first solo show in 30 years. So, hello, Ted. It's very nice to be talking to you.
I'm excited to be here.
Good. That's what I like people I'm chatting to. So you're in your 50s, you know about websites and technology, you write books and you paint. Like, we could be like brothers from another mother, as they say.
I know. Maybe it's the whole, did you just say I was in my 50s? Well, I guess I am. I guess I can't do that. Yeah, I'm in my 50s and I'm not sure why it is, except that if you're in your 50s, you've grown up with technology. And so you probably had to adapt to it in many different instances, and that's what I ended up doing through the whole process. Just adapt, trying to stay alive, just trying to get through the day like everybody else. So, but the whole technology has informed, to use an art school word, has informed so much of what I've done in the way of both my working to pay the bills and then also it's influenced my rendering and my artwork, because I got so immersed into doing Photoshop that became the way to my fortune, and you know, what such as they were in the magazines. So, and then that even, and the only reason I did really well at Photoshop was because I had all these years of classical painting, and it's all layers, and it just kind of clicked for me. So
yeah. Okay. Are you pleased with how your show is going?
Yeah, it's been crazy. I'm not a crowd person. And, you know, when you get approached to do a show and somebody said, well, actually, my husband blurted out, oh, he can do it. When they said, you know, would you do a show for us in a year from now? And I was like, well, I was counting how many paintings I had in my head. And I was like, well, yeah, sure. And then my husband goes, oh, yeah, he can do it. So it was weird for that year that, you know, where typically when I came back to painting, I was just giving myself time just sort of like to just reassess why painting, what's the process, why are you coming back to that, why has it always sort of been in the background and what attracted to you. So I gave myself like 3 years. I was going to do like 3 years and just play, just rediscover, come back to those basics. And then like somewhere around the second year, the gallery owner saw my stuff online. I had done a portrait for this April Ryan. She's a reporter here in town, but I'd done her children. And she started following me. And so she saw some other paintings and she said, would you bring your paintings down to the gallery? I'd like to see them. And I was like, okay. So I brought what I had, and then the whole discussion of the show came up. So it was weird for all these years not ever painting to be seen, and then all of a sudden to know that your stuff was going to be in, you know, in a public space for 30 days in a gallery show or whatever. So I tried to like bust through that whole like somebody's looking over your shoulder while you're painting kind of feeling, and really and just kind of embrace the idea of like, okay, what do you need to do in order to get to the next painting? How's this painting sort of speaking to the other painting, and is that important? What direction is going in? And what was weirder was I knew I was transitioning, because I could see the way I was responding more to the painting. So I could see where I was moving even from one painting to the next in a particular direction that wasn't what I had shown her originally in the pieces. So there was a sort of trepidation about, okay, is she even going to like what I show up with, you know, a year later and stuff too. So that wasn't a whole concept. So the show went off. And do you ever see Game of Thrones? Do you ever see that?
I did, series? Yeah. I had to stop watching it. It got too violent for me.
But yeah, it was horrible. But there's this scene in there, and I'm sure some of the other folks out there have seen it, but Cersei, who's this sort of evil and wonderful queen, she was captured and taken away into this church, and they made her walk through the city in this sort of walk of shame where everybody sort of abused her. Well, in order for her to get back to the castle, she had to walk through the city, and she, you know, had all these people attacking her and throwing things at her and stuff. So that's kind of how I entered the gallery, feeling that I was, you know, I had to get through all these people and they're like coming at you. I mean, it was bizarre. It was like, there were friends I hadn't seen in high school. There were people there showing up, and I was trying to see them, what they look like, you know, through 30 years of, you know, living and stuff. And so, and then everyone was grabbing your shoulder. And I literally, this is how bad it was. I could not, you know, and this is going to show what a foodie I was. I couldn't get to the hors d'oeuvres. I couldn't get to the table because people kept on they physically grab you on the shoulder and they yank you around and they start telling you their all this stuff on that. So it was bizarre because usually I'm the one that stands in the corner. I'm the one that just stands there and this like watches everybody and then, you know, nibbles on a crouton and leaves the gallery, that kind of thing. But so it was really hard to be engaging. And I know if you've had shows, it's you become the therapist in the room and everybody's going to come up to you and start telling their stories about how your pains have affected them or what you're really doing in your painting. They're going to explain it to you back, and it was wonderful. It was good. So yeah, it was very weird. We sold paintings. I was excited. Yay, sold them.
Good.
So
yeah, that's very funny. You know, the way your mindset walking into the gallery. I'm seriously on my walk of shame. Yeah,
it was horrible. I was like, I just need to get the hors d'oeuvre table. I'll be safe. They'll protect me. And never got there. Never got there. It's hell. Right.
And how long did you have to endure that for?
Let me tell you this. That thing went 7 to 9. It went to 11:30, John, and I was hoarse. The only cool thing about it was I kind of sounded like Bruce Springsteen because my voice was so shot at the end of the night and stuff. But because, you know, it was just crowded. You had to keep explaining and stuff. And at one point, I'm talking to the gallery owner and this corporate buyer for paintings, and they're being really intent and stuff. And over their shoulders in the back, there's these two very sort of wine drunk painters, and they're arguing about one of the paintings, and they're going up to one of my paintings, and I can't hear what they're saying, but they're gesturing at it, and the other one pulls his hand back and points down the other corner, and I'm like, I don't know what the hell's going on, but if this is the art world, I love it. No, it's strange.
And do you have like social anxiety, or was it just?
Oh, hard. I have like I'm test phobic. Like my mother was a school teacher, and she was very sort of hard on her own kids and stuff. So I mean, if you tell me there's going to be a test, like this interview, I prepped for it. Oh, I was ready for it because it's like ask me my own name on a test. I can't tell you. I just blank. I blank out completely. Stuff. So people asking me about my work and stuff. And what's weird, this is what's really, it's like, so I did that one painting, The Holy Confrontation. So we have these two very kind of housewivey people, and it's Raphael's crucifix, right? So and we'll probably talk a little bit later about this, but I sort of have this very intuitive way of finding these people who they're real, and I'm stealing their images on my iPhone, however I can surreptitiously capture them. And so I had this image up there, and then this crucifix, you know, the whole scene sort of crops to make it contemporary and fit in with the piece that I'm trying to do. And I'm talking to this woman who I know is a devout Catholic on it, and she's asking me about it, and I was like, well, I'm comfortable. I know why I did it, because, you know, and the reason why the title came about and stuff, but I started censoring myself in there because I didn't want to make her feel uncomfortable as to where I was coming from. And I like, never when I was painting it did I think that I'd have to do this sort of weird sort of counseling on the thing. And she was getting it, and she kind of dug it and stuff, but it was just like, at the time I was like, It's weird to be standing in front of something that you spent on that painting was, you know, 8 weeks, 10 weeks, and you have this really intimate relationship of why you're going to be doing it. And then somebody is standing there from a particular point of view, and they're looking at it, and you suddenly realize that you don't want them to be uncomfortable about the situation, but I know why I did it, you know, because I wanted to say, you know, I go around and I'll say, you know, the car comes coming at us. I'll be like, oh my God, the car almost hit us. Or there'll be some sort of weird thing that happened. And I'll say, Jesus, da, 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 da. But I'm not Christian. You know, I mean, I can't, you know, being gay in the South, being raised and seeing the way it was treated, it's like, you know, I'm not like, I don't embrace it, but it's such a part of me. And then, you know, so I said to my husband the other, when I started painting this, it was like, there's people having this intense argument about it. And I was like, you know, whether you're, I don't care what, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, whatever, there is a human factor that comes in where you sort of have to confront this whole sense of like, all right, do I believe something? Is there a process? Was I just trained for it? You know, so that's where I was coming from. But this woman is sweet. She's so nice. And she's very smart and articulate and everything. But I just had this weirdness that happened. I don't know if it was transphobia or what. I was just like, I'm not really ready to discuss this at this point in my life with you, you know.
Oh, that's hilarious.
It was bizarre. Yeah. So that was just like one of the, you know, episodes of that night and stuff too. So it was like, and then everyone kept on, of course, John, which one of those, you've looked at some of the catalog, right?
Yep.
Which painting do you think sold first?
Say the one of the guy on the train. I can't remember the name of it. Here we go.
Oh, I wish that were true. No, Bella, the bulldog.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
Oh,
yeah.
My God. Why was that sold? I wanted that paint. I'm like, you know, that was kind of the whole point of the painting, that somebody in L.A. bought that. They saw it online, and they did that, and then bought that. And I was just like, part of me did it almost, you know, it is my dog, but part of me did it was because so many artists I know today, they make their living off of painting pet portraits. It's almost like people will pay to have their animals done a portrait before they'll have their kids done. It's so, and I was just like, but you know, I got my dog, I'm gonna paint my dog. But then it was like, she's a princess, but and that was another weird thing is like, here you do all this stuff. I mean, this is my stuff. This is my dog, you know, and this is, you know, these are my images that I see. And now they belong to somebody else. They're going to somebody else.
Yeah.
I sort of have a problem with that kind of stuff. But, you know, and it's weird because when I was talking to the gallery owner, she was looking at the paintings and she said this basic in her, for Richmond, Virginia, which is sort of a, you know, the capital of the South, but it is sort of a sleepy town compared to like New York or, you know, LA or whatever. But she knows her market and she's really good. And so she was looking at it and she said, your paintings kind of fall into two different categories. And for lack of a better term, we came up with sort of the editorial high concept pieces, which were included like the Holy Confrontation and the pieces wherever I use classical paintings in it. And she said, and then the other ones, which more, which was the guy riding the train and the folks just out on the street. And she said those she felt like would be where people could come and they could identify with it. And it wasn't so sort of in your face with like concept. It was more just there. Man, she nailed it. They sold out. All those were gone, just gone like that.
And which ones? The ones the with more,
the day-to-day ones. Yeah. Oh, the high yeah. concept. Yeah. 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 Which I know because and you know the city and I know Richmond pretty good because we were there for so many years with the magazines, but you kind of know where the sense of almost like where the more conceptual pieces, the more sort of art form esque pieces are going to land. And if you take them into like a larger urban area, I don't know, there's more people with that larger amount of taste, so maybe that demographic's going to be appeal to it more or something, but you know, but yeah, all of it, it's always painting what you know and trying to, but then digesting it and processing it in a way. I have absolutely no way of knowing like if it's going to come out with more of a high concept, if it's going to be more of a direct piece on there. So
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, you're probably better off not to think about that till it's done. Hey?
Right. And each piece was one piece to me. It's like one piece leads to the next, and not. And I did keep them up in the room pretty much. And when I would go and see, well, how did I handle that, or what was that process for, you know, resolving that situation. I would look back and forth on them, but the whole process of quoting classical pieces, the Latour, the David, the Raphael, that came about really from actually looking at the paintings and then and seeing what I kept on doing. And what I kept on doing was, because I'm so enmeshed in art history, I kept on quoting all these other painters, either in compositions or in the way they would handle things. And at first, I began to just, it didn't happen. Like the guy really going somewhere is the name of the painting, but yeah. All right. So that was really kind of the first one, because what I wanted to do was I was moving away from pre-engineering a painting. I'm trying to move away from all those years where I was doing that kind of hyper-realism, using grisaille and then the layers and working with the oil painting stuff, all that. I wanted to move away from that. And I really wanted to get it where the painting is an event. If you give yourself over to the event, the process will kind of lead you as to how to handle both verisimilitude versus painting and letting paint be paint. So I'm trying to move that way. Not an easy thing to do. And so that painting was the first one where I was on the metro and I saw this guy who was in this incredible blue suit, and he had this fiery red hair, and he's just sitting there on our way to, I don't know where we're going, resting or something. And I was like, I got to get this guy's picture. And his profile was just so kind of amazing. So I snapped it. And so I'm working on this painting, and we're talking like, 6 weeks into it or whatever. I keep looking at this painting, and it's like keeps registering back to me. Like, not that I've seen it before, but I'm like, this is so familiar. This is so familiar. Yeah. So that's when I go, and then I was like, oh my God, this is Whistler's mother. And I go, and it was like, the frame, everything was right there. So that happened to me like three times in the process of last year, where I'm working on something and then bam, it hits me. Like, I'm going on. So I'm like, well, this must be something that is sort of vital to development. So why not be a little bit more obvious about your quoting history, and you're looking at history and you're sort of smashing this contemporary classicism together. So that's when I started doing the more what my gallery only layer, the editorial pieces, where it's where I'm actually quoting segments of other painters and then having the gallery goers in front of it.
Yeah, so, yeah. It's funny. I had Adam Miller on the podcast last year, and he's gone similar but different approach, in that he's kind of taken the approach of, there are some paintings that are just brilliant, they're celebrated, and they've got very classic kind of compositions. So I'm going to take those compositions as the kind of building blocks for my paintings, and he'll Photoshop them in and composite them in, the actual original paintings, and mix them up and basically go, yeah, I know this works because it's worked as a classic painting. So my composition is definitely going to work, you know? So in say if he was going about the Here We Go painting, he would have taken Whistler's mother as and put that's the first layer, if you know what I mean. And then he would have got his models in. Now you sit a bit like that and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I actually I had one painter doing the show come up and kind of yell at me. Oh. And say, and all right, and I'm from the South, so I'm gonna slaughter names, but it's Ingres. Is that how you say it?
Oh, gotcha. Right, yeah.
Yeah. So I did. I'm using him in with Bella, and I have the princess that he painted. It was like the last portrait he did, and they're like, you know, I would be really pissed at you if he saw what you did to his. I'm like, okay, I don't think I have to worry about that, but okay, thank you for that information. Here's some more wine. And so it's just, there was like, people really got upset. You know, they're just like, you don't do that. I was like, what are you supposed to? I mean, it was there.
Oh, people. People get worked up about the funniest things.
I know. I'm there.
Okay, well, let's put things in context. What painters do you rate?
That I like a whole lot? Or?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, painters that, all right, this is what I've been sort of haunted by for years, and I think it's the whole, because of the way, because I am in my 50s or whatever. So you're in art school and you're painting, and you're closeted, you're not sure if you're gay or straight or whatever. So naturally, you move over to Hockney, and then everybody starts talking about Hockney to you, and you're like, your work looks like Hockney, and I got that. And John, I swear, in the opening, this girl that came up to me from art school said Hockney to me 7 times in a row, and I was just like, look, girl, chill it on the Hockney. I got it. I'm gay. I get it. We've moved forward. We're not there anymore. So, but then, so, you know, but it was Hockney for a while, John, I have to admit. It was like, you know, and it was me really more because I can get you there. Because when I was growing up in the South at Virginia Museum of Fine Arts, they have a huge collection of American folk art painting, like they say American primitive, but you know, colonials from the 1700s and stuff. So they have a lot of these really flattened portraits of families and stuff. I just loved somehow the compression of that their drawing and the how their drawing, even though it was accurate to the way the artist had interpreted, it was considered primitive in the sense that it wasn't, you know, European trained or whatever kind of stuff. You know, John Singleton, Copley, Edward Hicks, those kind of things. I just, oh my God, I ate that stuff up. And this is before I went to art school. So then Hockney has that flattening he does. And his was sort of that Egyptian, I mean, it was pop, but it was sort of that mashing of reality and to get the flatness of it. And also at the time, he was doing representational work that I wasn't seeing a whole lot of other places, that he was, his genius and the finessing of the drawing was all there. And so that was that. So it was hiding for a while. I was in school and stuff, and the flatness of it. And then Francis Bacon and the way he sort of built his own reality. But again, that weird flatness, that compression of it. There's something about that kind of spoke to me. So I really liked that. And I was really big on, I was really big in oil painting in undergrad school. And I was really big on and rendering and verisimilitude and, you know, what is the reality of Trump Loy and or is it illusion? That kind of, what is more accurate? That sort of stuff. So
yeah.
Anyway, so so it was all that representational stuff. And then it wasn't until I got into grad school I think there were 2 figurative painters and there were like 8 minimalist painters. And it was a lot of interesting discussions going on. But, you know, I picked up a lot of stuff from them. But one of the things was that they talked about was Mirandi. And I really got into Mirandi. It just clicked with me. And I mean, he was like God. I mean, I think that was as close as they would get to figurative without, you know, like throwing stuff at you or something. They were very anti-figurative work. They had this one huge argument. I mean, it lasted for like 3 hours whether photography was an art form or not.
And
it was
just, right. It was
good times. So.
This is in the 80s, yeah.
This was in the 80s. Yeah. They were big on Bryce Martin. He was God. In fact, one of them had been his intern or an assistant before he had just come to graduate school. So there was a lot of that sort of chit-chat going on. And everybody talked about flat surfaces. The surfaces had to be flat, Yeah. And, you know, that kind of thing. So.
And anyway. Who do you like now that's painting now?
Well, I like a lot of people. I like a lot of people whose works I have seen and whose works I have not seen, and I love their stuff. So now, I have this big thing right now for I like Duncan Grant, and the one that usually connects right away is like Bonnard. I like Vuillard. I just saw a real Vuillard. We were in Chicago, and we just saw they have in there. I think post-impressionist collection, they have a couple of his, and I'd never seen his stuff before. Oh my God, it's amazing stuff. But then, you know, I like Alice Neal, you know, Sylvia Slay, there's a lot of the figure. It's anyone that can carry James Marshall. I saw the show at was it MCA or whatever? Oh man, that was fabulous. That was him. But people that can, it's those painters that have the ability to take what they're painting and process it in a way that is such a signature, but it's their own world.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what to me, it's like, you know, they're the painter's kind of process too. So, you know, that's right. The deal. Notice I didn't say Surratt one time. Isn't that crazy? I don't.
Yeah, no, I can see that.
I get that all the time. I get that. So hey, we were there. We were at we were in Chicago. I was my husband's daughter, Jade Smitherman. She's a ceramicist, and she and I do a lot of museum hopping together. So she and I were there, and we're looking at the pointillism pieces that they have at the Chicago Art Institute, and we're looking around, and I walked up, and I'm pointing to, what is it, they're in the park, and they have, you know, the little monkey and all those, yeah, all the nice ladies that were,
yeah, I can't remember the name of it, but yeah,
yeah. I know. My mom used to love that, and until I told her they're, most of them were prostitutes that they're like
the monkeys.
No, not the monkeys.
Well, you don't know.
You never know, crazy Surratt.
You never know with monkeys.
So anyway, so I'm like, yep. So I'm like, gesture. I said, now that's pointillism. And GA's like, oh no, that's not pointillism. Surratt did not consider himself a pointillist. He was a blah 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 blah. I was like, God, nobody wants to be considered a pointillist. And I didn't get the thing. Is it's like I get it, and I know I should embrace it. Like, you know, I was going to come up and say pointillism today, and it's. And it was. And if you look at even that one that you circulated on Instagram, the first one, it's called the Metro. Hmm. It's a woman silhouette. And I get it, because what I did was, all right, 4 years, 3 years ago, I was going back to all the bits and pieces that I picked up and said, okay, what is it you really like? So I'm doing this painting. And at one point, I think I was painting a bird, and I made this mark with this one type of brush. And I'm like, God, I really like that mark. I'm going to make an entire painting just with this one brush and this mark on this huge painting. So I get through that, and I was like, oh, because I'd worked with all the minimalists, and they had all one of their flat surfaces, they were mixing a lot of different kind of chemicals and mixers in their paints to flatten it out. And one of the things that they really talked about, which resonated with me, was they wanted the color to be seen. They didn't want anything to get between the color and the viewer. So the more matte the color, the more that you would see the actual saturation of the hue, and the light would not be reflected in a way like if you use varnish or whatever, which actually was the antithesis of what I've been doing up until graduate school, because I want everything as plastic. I wanted to, you know, use varnish to hide all the brush strokes, and I wanted to be glossy, 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 glossy. Mm-hmm. And they're like, no, no, no. Hues are what should be seen. It should be serene. It should be matte. Anyway, so I was like, okay, I bought into it. I was like, so, when I went back to painting, I couldn't even remember. It's something called silica or silica. We went to the Golden's paint factory. There we go. And they would actually get this raw material to mix in with their paints. So the closest thing I could get to it was I started using plaster of Paris. And I used that as my medium mixed in with this sort of super matte medium. And then I use a little bit of pumice in with it, and it creates, what it does is when it dries is pure matte, and so it's like pure color, but it also sets up in this really wonderful, you can see the bristles of the brushwork, and if you just leave it alone, if you make that one mark and then step back for it, it creates this beautiful object. And it, like, you know, like a snowflake, it cannot be repeated again and again. But if you're up, if you're inches in front of that, and you start stacking these brush strokes, it gets real like de Kooning-esque. It's super painterly. So it really taught me a lot about scale, because you know, you don't need, you know, a 9 foot by, you know, 8 foot canvas, whatever. And the zebra to make this, you know, super painterly environmental. If you're standing there in scale and if you're looking at the viewer length, and so I start calling it easel painting. If you're just doing easel painting and you have this brush, you can get really this pretty impressive experience going if you sort of like let the brush guide you and you get into it. So that's how I got into. So all right, so I'm doing this painting. I go into it. I step back and I'm like, congratulations, you just rediscovered pointillism. And I'm like, what? I can't win. So I did the Metro piece. And then so I step back and I look at the Metro piece. And it's, all right, there's something better about that. It's not quite so. And I realized what was happening was I was trying to render. I was trying to do verisimilitude. I was trying to do the kind of, I was trying to control the painting through pre-engineering of drawing, making sure all the shadows and all the tones and everything was sort of, and still not, I wasn't being true to being a painter. I was kind of being half-assed about it. I was like, all right, you've got to let go of some things. You cannot have all this stuff. So I let go of verisimilitude. I let go of shadows. I let go of tones, which that was what was the pointillism was really trying to capture, a certain sense of verisimilitude and being there and actually rendering, you know, because Seurat was this incredible draftsman and stuff. So he really, if you look at his paintings, they are kind of colorless. And I know that they had these sort of corrupt ideas about color, which I like. But they, those, even with this sort of corrupt theory and stuff, their whole presentation, there's very few, there's a lot of post-impressionists that actually, and the Nabby, and they kind of got more towards where I'm coming from. So you need to kind of like, if you're going to go with the process, let the process inform you and sort of let go of trying to hang on. And because it's very liberating. It's sort of not unlike coming out of the closet. It's very liberating. You kind of release yourself. You say, okay, this is what you are. You're just going to go with that. So I was just like, I went with it. And then what happens is, as you got like really going some places, the guy on the train, he was the first one where I was coming dangerously close to Milton Avery's sort of work, but there was something there. Because the blue of that suit, it took me like, I don't know, 3 weeks of just hitting it. And finally, I was like, that's the right blue. Yeah, it was right. You know? And so that what happens is like you, I'm making these marks. I never know what layer is going to be the final layer. So there's that bit of process. You know, right, besides the ship in the bottle, kind of when people see it, you know, like, oh, how did you do all this? It's not that. It's like when you're standing in front of it, there's layers in there that honestly got our fluorescent pink, and they will sparkle from underneath there. If you stand there, you'll start to see it, and it sort of enlivens the surface. So the brush strokes themselves are beautiful objects. I'm stacking these in a way, and I'm trying to do it in a way to maintain the figure without going into some sort of pure abstraction. But also, so how do I handle like rendering? How do I handle where typically I would draw a line? So I kind of have to build the painting up to create these crevices that become the edges that delineate arms and legs and these other pieces. So it doesn't translate at all in the computer world. In RGB color, it doesn't work. Nope. You can't see it. You can't see it at all.
Well, you get I hear what you're saying, yeah, but you do get a sense of it. You get a sense of something because I haven't seen any of your stuff in reality. I've just seen it on a computer or on my phone or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
I get what you're saying about pointillism, but to me the thing that really stood out, because I mean it's the first obvious kind of thing to kind of notice, but then the more I looked at your stuff, I have actually seen some of Seurat's stuff in real life, and there's something really still about his pictures. It's almost like you could walk in among all those people and none of them would be moving. That's the impression I get.
Yeah.
Um, but yours are very vital. There's a vibrancy to it that's not in his. Like, that's where any kind of comparison would stop for me, is that yours have a... there's a big movement going on in there. It's probably all those layers you were just describing.
Yeah. The other thing that I'm coming to it as, you know, the thing, this is what they do. They're like, you'll be watching a show on like extraterrestrials, or it'll be like a ghost something or other, or ESP. And they'll be like telekinetic powers. And they're like, well, we went in there and we discovered that they were actually da da da. And if you use a magnetic field, you can cause the spoon to bend or whatever. So, and they were like, and the big pushback is like, yo, dude, just because you can explain something with science doesn't mean there isn't actually a ghost there, that you're just using a different process to get to that. You know, that doesn't deny that process. So when I said I rediscovered pointillism, I was also coming at it from the, like, years and years of being face to the screen, close in pixels on Photoshop, making the beautiful people beautiful, and you have to zoom in on pixels, and those, that becomes your reality. And if you're really good at it, you know, it becomes seamless, and you are constantly zooming in at 400% to move away, you know, a mole or crow's feet or whatever to make somebody, you know, presentable for the magazine. So you're doing all this stuff. And then that becomes a reality. So I'm constantly zooming in and zooming back and zooming back. And so I had all these years of digital development and working with pixels. And so to me, when I started making these marks, I was like, well, this is not, I'm like a pixel count and you're moving in. And what's even weirder, this is so bizarre. You talk about how something influences you. You know, when you're doing web development, everything is based on the top left corner, right? So everything that you do for compressing down to mobile view or to expand, you have to start with the top left corner, and then all the pixels that way, you can compress that way to make something skinny or extend the magazine page, whatever. It's all top left. When I paint now, every layer I start with, I start in the top left corner, and I go across. I tried to break myself in it. It was just like years and years. Top left, and then you know, you wave across with the, you know, the veil of paint chips that go on that stuff too. But I don't know. It just was weird thing. So it's pixel. So now I'm doing these pixel, you know, and so like, and I have friends. They're some of them are. I have friends who I've never met. These people are on Facebook and Instagram. We talk back and forth. There's a guy, Todd Hale, and then there's this other guy, Eric Yevek. That's how well I know him. I can't pronounce his last name, but it's Y-E-V-A-K. He just got done in graduate school. But what they're doing, they have, and we, I think Todd and I have chatted about this. It's like, they're painters, and the aspect of real materials is really important. But they want to do something digital, but you don't want it to be a digital experience. You want to use digital, but you don't want it to, the end process to be read as digital or be a, you know, video artist or whatever the or process is. So they're using digital in really interesting ways. And so I wanted to use digital and I wanted to use Photoshop, but I didn't want to Photoshop a painting. I didn't want to do that. But it was such a part of what I did. So now I don't do any kind of preliminary sketches. Everything is either pretty much off my iPhone, or if I'm pulling from the classical paintings or whatever, I'll just yank it off the internet and then I'll crop into it and make it whatever. But the idea is like, I'll build the actual to size and scale in Photoshop. I'll build the basis, the source material for the painting. Then once I get it to be, I've manipulated enough and I think it's fine. And they're really crappy Photoshop layers and stuff because I'm not worried about it. So when I print them out, but I print them out on my husband's printer and it only does 8.5 by 11 sheets. So I have to tile it. So I have to go back and then cut and paste, you know, I mean, if I was Cindy Sherman, I'd be printing these things out or whatever, but you know, full size. So what it does though, it makes me really get to know that piece of artwork while I'm building the source material. So I grid it all out on the poster piece, tape it all together like a little high school kid. And then I put it up on the wall. And that becomes the source for what I draw on the canvas. And then from the raw canvas, I start with charcoal and I draw a real basic sketch and I draw from there. And then everything else is just, I'm painting, looking at that thing on the wall. So what I'm really doing, John, I'm a still life painter and I'm actually painting those flat images on the wall. So I'm just a still life painter. I'm just painting printouts off.
Do you, I was wondering about that. Do you, you know, because sometimes when people use their iPad for reference rather than the printout, they can make a blurry version of their source material to so they don't have to squint all the time, you know, to, for example, or they'll make a black and white version to help them with values. I was wondering, yeah. do you don't make a pixelated version to help you with the way you work?
No, because, and if you look at the paintings, it's the association of pixel to the piece is gone. It's more, I always think more, they're more like Legos. The brush strokes are more like little Legos and you piece together kind of stuff. The idea of the pixelation, the use of digital comes in as sort of my pre-sketch, or you've people do pre-paintings, those little studies or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, and what's nice about it is because I've worked all those years in magazines and you're constantly pulling in backgrounds and taking away backgrounds and seeing work, I can bring up, you know, five or four different versions of a painting. And I was like, and I'll do, you know, I'll try different things in the background, and then all of a sudden it'll just click intuitively, like that's the right,
yeah,
you know, painting for that piece. But, and that gives me the speed and the ability, which I, you know, years ago I used to cut out and do collages and all that other stuff. So it wasn't, you know, yeah, it just speeds things along that way. Yeah. So.
Okay. Just let's go back a little bit. How does the whole idea for the painting start for you?
I am in the street and I will see couples arguing or something, and they're gesticulating in a way that's really kind of cool. Or I'll be in an airport and a couple will be making out, and I'm not stalking these people. I'm waiting for people. And, you know, in an airport, they're always going to jump on each other anyway. It's all like hello, goodbye kind of stuff. So I have my iPhone and I'm taking pictures, and then eventually, it usually starts with the person in front of the artwork, and then I will look at them and then just start browsing paintings that I know about and lots of times paintings that I don't know about, and then I'll just, it'll click as to what works really well, and then it comes together. And then other times too, okay, this is the other thing, all right, we're going back to painting, why are you painting, Ted, what's going on, blah blah blah. So I came up with this thinking, like, and just because I didn't want to say, oh, this is good, this is bad, or whatever, it's kind of ahistorical, but I came up with this idea of, like, easel painting. Like, all right, so I live in Northern Virginia, and the reality is most people don't have the McMansions to put huge paintings in, and that if you're – what we've done is gone back to almost, like, pre-European – pre-modernist times, where an easel painting was could fit in someone's home and they could deal with it. And so you see a lot of easel size paintings around here. So I'm like, well, what's a good easel painting? So I made ahistorical, I don't care, impressionist, modern, what, contemporary, what. But the first thing is like a large scale painting, which everyone sort of jumps on for that, particularly when because I was in New York in the 80s and everybody was doing postmodernism and Schnabel was smashing plates and whatever up on these huge canvases or whatever. So we started same time, like large scale is not always a necessary, a large impact. Sometimes it's just yards of wasted canvas. You know, it's just like, so you see these things. It's like, yeah, it's impressive. It's really big, but how is it really serving the, you know, the painting? So the other thing that easel painters do is like, they don't question the whole process of what a painting is. You know, like when I was in graduate school, we kind of walked down this weird road where everybody was questioning that. And I did too. I was like questioning, like, well, okay, why do we have to paint on a rectangle? Why can't it be just this blob? You know, that kind of thing. So I would do a lot of that whole weird challenging of institution. But when the easel painters did, like if they're really good, say if you're like Bonnard or somebody, you could – you would like, all right, this is the canvas, put it up on the wall on the easel, paint the sides, and you can just literally, you can paint anything, and it works. It's they kind of just embrace the process without having to reinvent it, it's not unlike, like, you know, writers, like a novelist. Like, yeah, I know there's a lot of concrete poetry writing and stuff like that, but for the most part, like, writers, they'll just embrace the novel form or embrace the poet form, the poem form, like a poet would do that. And it's like, that's their literary engineering, and they're just going to accept that and then build innovation or develop their thinking within that form. So yeah. I'm like, okay, yeah, so let's go back to that form. So that's what they want to do. And another thing easel painters do, that it's that they can paint anything, but it's not like today on Instagram where everything is image based and the image is sort of the reason why I want to create something. The rendering of that subject matter for a really good easel painter, it's like it's part of the process, but not necessarily the reason for the painting. You know, the painting is going to have its own objectness and its own presence that the subject matter is giving to. On Instagram today, you see, and it's all image-based, image, 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 and the whole objectness, the beauty of the actual painting and the surface, you know, obviously it's lost because it's RGB color, but there's a certain disconnect between, like, when you go and stand before a painting, you know, you can really immerse yourself in that experience. It's texture, it's hue, it's the way light's being reflected at that moment on that thing, that it's more than just what is being rendered, you know, on the piece. So
that's, yeah, it's a good point, but what are we going to do about that? Because Instagram, little small screens, they're not going away, I don't think.
Yeah, but listen to this.
Yeah,
that's what I like about Instagram, is because these, and those are all the artists whose work I haven't seen, but I love their stuff.
Yeah. It's like, and you wouldn't Instagram. Have seen them otherwise, possibly. Yeah,
I only know them virtually. I mean, I know other stuff. There's this whole hashtag called aftermodernism, which I'm not quite sure what that means, but I love it. It's just like this weird. And then it was like, when I saw it, I was like, who do I write to get, like, my aftermodernism certificate so I can join this group? Because I really like their paint. Like, who came up with that? And then I thought, is that somebody? Is that a person? Because I don't know with these hashtags. I'm new. But there's this guy who's got Ridley Howard. Is that, like, the most fabulous name in the world? But anyway, his paintings are really nice. I really like his work. Never met him. And I only like, really, his Instagram images, but he's really good on that. There's Jocelyn, Hobie, H-O-B-B-I-E. She's good. Allison Blickle, Tom Sanford. All these guys, their work has this weird, it's hard to explain. It looks really good on Instagram. It's rendered. They've got their own stamp or their own brand on the figures.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's hard to explain, but there is an affinity there, and it all just pops up under it. So I just started tagging mine after modernism because I want to be part of the cool group. And so I was like, accept me, like me. Like me on Facebook or whatever. That's the other weird stuff. It's like, I just don't get it. I don't get, my husband, he's really, he's like the social media, he's always been this really social media wizard. And he has, you know, thousands of people. Like, you know, he says one boo and they all retreat it and do all this other stuff. But he has to, because he works with all these celebrities and stuff. So he has to be sort of present and stuff like that. But I've had my same, like, 7 followers for the last 5 years. And, you know, that's good, Ted. Like, that's the best, Ted. Like, and I'm like, well, that's good.
Well, it's because you haven't been using that hashtag. I think if you use that hashtag, your life's going to change.
I know. And the hashtagging, seriously, there's an art to it. If I put queer art hashtag on my stuff, I get, and it's weird because there's nothing on it, like, and I don't know, and I hope I'm not offending anybody because, you know, they really embrace queer art hashtag or whatever, but it was like, I'll do a landscape and there's really nothing on there to identify or for you to, like, get the theme or the feel of queer art or stuff. The man, that thing will get hit with a like and a like and a like. Admittedly, I'm sure a lot of them, they're up at 3 a.m. on happy drugs and like, whoa, yeah, hit that guy. But of course, I say that, but then you do a thing with a French bulldog hashtag, and then you get hit with a lot of people. Boom, 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 boom. They love
it. Oh, yeah. It's a completely different group. Anytime I put a picture of my dogs up and I'll hashtag Scottish Terriers or something like that, I get a whole other group of people who like it.
I know. It's the weirdest thing. But what is nice about it is, like, I do get, like, and this is weirdly thrilling, you know, I'm an old man, so it's thrilling to have these, like, I'll have people in Russia who like my work, and then there's, you know, Russia, England, you know, all these places and stuff. I was like, well, somebody's seen my little old painting.
That's right. Well, that's what I was getting at. Like, I totally get what you're saying. Everyone should really stand in front of paintings, but we're not going to for the most part, you know. We're mostly going to look on our little tiny phone. And while that's like so sad in one way, and another way, at least we're getting to see something that we wouldn't otherwise see.
But John, you've just done that horrible thing that we've all done. You're just disappointing. We did that thing where, you know, you go to a band and you get some audiophile guy who's like, well, you know, analog is much better than CD recording, dude, or whatever. And you're like, yeah, I get that, but I can play it on my iPhone. And so we'll take a step down for accessibility for our art forms and our, you know, our music and stuff, in order to have access to it, you know. And what technology's done is it's like it's given us access to other artists, but it has not given us access to their work. And everyone tends to start to sort of confuse this, you know, the friending and liking and stuff. I'm not saying this because I'm bitter and I only have 7 followers, but the point is there's a distinction made where you can't value is your Facebook audience your true audience? I hardly think so. You know, these people in Russia and stuff, they're liking the Instagram image on there. There's an affinity. And yes, I'm glad I make that connection. But really, I think when someone comes and stands in front of your painting and they'll say, you know, this how this moved them or whatever stuff, it's a completely different take on there, you know. So
true, I agree. But I kind of live in the hope that the technology will improve in some way so that we can, whether it's in virtual reality or whatever, that we can experience it better. It'll never be as good probably, but better. And then the other side of that is, like most artists who paint, sell their work to usually one person and it's never seen again.
Yeah, that's true.
One person gets to stand in front of it every day. Lucky them, great and everything. But, you know, it comes back to why do you paint? Like, do you paint for that one person or so that lots of people can stand in front of your painting and be moved by it?
That's true. The other thing, too, this is what I think about the other day. John, what if I went out and I got you, just for the hell of it, what if I got you an Andy Warhol and just gave it to you? Would you ever tell anybody you had that Andy Warhol in your house? Work? It's like people generally do not like say, hey, who have you collected lately? Or, yo, John, so I got a new lawnmower, but what about your, you know, de Kooning? Is that still hanging up there? What have you done? You know, you never do. People don't talk about art collections or their personal work. And then I was like, no, hell no. If I had any Warhol, I would keep my mouth shut. You don't want you know, to invite trouble.
You mean like burglary or?
Yeah, well, you know, there's that. And also it's this weird thing. It was like, who am I going to tell? My sister? Hey, Jan, I got Andy Warhol. She'd be like, who? What's a war? You know, I just don't sort of travel in those crowds. Yeah. But, you know, it's just like, but if you think about it, like when people are chatting and stuff, they'll talk about the, you know, cars they collect. They talk about that. But you don't hear people talking about, you know, art collection. You see it. They're trying to generate that. You talk about technology. They're trying to generate that with all the art collecting apps that are out there now, and they're trying to make that put a whole zeitgeist of technology and, you know, millennials. Hey, you starting your collection? Why not think about a, you know, whatever? And then that sort of QVC on an app mentality, that shopping network process for art.
Yeah. Which,
it's not bad, but it's all weird.
Well, I mean, some artists, they, you know, they sell exclusively on Etsy or somewhere like that, and they do okay. You know, they do. They at least they don't have to give the gallery half the money, kind of thing, and they indirect contact with their collectors. So it's a way.
It is a way. It is a way. It truly is.
If you're enjoying this podcast, remember you can support it by going to patreon.com/John Dalton gently does it. Well, you've kind of jumped a little bit forward here in my questions, but that's all right. But just when, because you were saying about, you know, collectors and all that kind of thing, I had Daniel Maidman on the podcast last year, and he was saying that in the art world, there's no middle class. There's the high-end artists selling for millions, and then there are the artists that sell their work in the low thousands, you know, after the galleries take their cut.
Right.
And there's nothing in the middle. So do you think he's right? And why do you think it's like that, if he is right?
Is he an American?
Yeah. He's an art critic for the Huffington Post.
Oh, Huffington. Okay. The Americans have this weird thing. They're like all or nothing. It's A or B. That's it. Why am I going to do that stuff? I think there's a whole range of, like, you know, I said my husband works for celebrities. So we're working with, he also deals with a lot of production people, and he does PR people. In other words, so we have, when you see a star, there's usually this huge, there's this huge entourage behind them greasing the wheels that people never see and never get to talk about. I think in the art world, there's commercial, the commissions, there's just layers and layers of selling and marketing and opportunities for artists to do their work. But I think the old way of developing, we're looking at it, is there's the art market at the auction level, the Sotheby's or whatever. And then there's a level where they jump way down and they go into, well, it's bohemia, and they're just struggling between. And I think there are lots and lots and lots and lots of people who do collections. I mean, there's this one couple who, they were that New York couple, and they collected for years.
Yeah.
So there's that level. And when I was at the show, that was what the gallery owner, she has her whole collection of folks. And her whole thing was, there's new tech money coming in to the Richmond area, which Richmond never had before. And she said, and these people are coming in, and there are folks who, you know, they're millennials, and they have these jobs where they don't have to actually be in the town. They can remote in. So all of a sudden, this new capital is coming into Richmond, and it's capital that are in the hands of people who appreciate art. And she said, and they're coming in and they're buying her stuff. And she had an experience prior to that. And then she also has her whole collection of corporate people who do buying for the pieces, for the different buildings and their different efforts as projects as corporations. So she said, you know, there's just a lot of folks that just weren't buying art before now aren't. Or she said there's the gay couples. She loves the gay couples because when they come in there, dinks, dual income, no kids, and they're spending money on art for each other and that kind of thing. So she, you know, she's built the relationship up with it. When people say lots of times when they go after the galleries and stuff, and granted, you know, 50% is a lot to take for any kind of project on there, but it's not the rent of the studios that the galleries that these people are paying off is that they spent, just like, you know, artists will say, I spent years developing my craft and you want to give me, you know, $2,000 for this? Are you crazy? The gallery owners have built these relationships up, and they, over the years, with their buyers. And if they really do have buyers who will come in there and start collecting your work, that to me is sort of the effort. Now, I don't have that kind of exorbitant relationship cost with my gallery. She's much more reasonable, but stuff. But when she said to me, how much do you want for your work? I said, I want to get into collections. I'm much more interested, you know, and fortunately, I've worked hard to be able to be in a situation where I can afford to say that. But that, you know, in a weird sort of way, was part of the plan, is that your value comes the more you are collected and the more you can get in the hands of people, because people will turn them into keepsakes. They will tell you, talk about other people. You know, Warhol, brilliant, knew his market, and he said, if you want to sell paintings to a lot of, you know, really nice collections, he said, you find one wealthy woman who is in charge of her household. He's saying this, not me, but and saying, I just don't want to do hate mail. He's saying, you find that one woman, and he said, her friends will become jealous and they'll want to come and buy something. And that's how he's got entree into that whole sort of New York market, was he was really smart in picking out, and he would, you know, obviously he had a lot of other feelers out there, but he knew his market. He knew his crowd. And it wasn't like high-end art collectors at first. It was women who were very competitive with their collections in there. And, it, you know, and so he sort of pandered to them and did that. And I'm going to slog his name, Kehinde Wiley. Mm-hmm. Same deal. He was super smart. He tapped into the rap community, and there's a lot of competition in hip hop about who has what, and there's a lot of setting status symbols up. And he turned his work into the sort of status symbol that you sort of a must-have stuff, which I think is absolutely brilliant. And he did it, and he also did it by making a really kind of cool statement about African Americans and in art history and in general, that whole process. Brilliant, brilliant, and stuff, and authentic. And then he rose, and he, if you look at his stuff, he's not unlike Warhol, because, you know, he has his factory and he has his people working on it, and you know, he's commodified to now that I think there's stained glass windows, there's vases, there's this whole accoutrement of, you know, Wiley stuff that is, you know, and how smart is that? It's like you there is a market, sure, there's the classic art collector market, but then there are markets that you can sort of tap into if you're sort of sensitive and smart about what you're doing.
Yeah, very good. You've kind of answered this question, but I want to ask it anyway because it's from somebody on Instagram. It's from the artist Agnes Grokulska, and she says, I saw Ted's show in Richmond, Virginia last Friday. The texture of his paintings is something else in real life. Modern day frescoes on stucco when done by Surratt's great grandson. ask him to talk about his process with Plaster Paris, please. So you kind of talked about it, but is there anything else you want to add for her? I thought it was nice what she said.
Whatever. That is nice what she said. She's running. I did meet her.
You did? Oh, good.
Yeah, she was there. She was there again. The weird thing about it is, it's like people keep coming up to me and asking me, like, do you have that rough surface that you're painting on? Which is that weird thing. Did you de Kooning's paintings, if you look at his paintings, I would swear that he probably did half of those paintings. Like, you know, if he did the Diana Ross paintings, right? You know, he's doing this painting and stuff, and or the woman or whatever. You'd swear the way it looks, that painting was done in 20 minutes tops. Maybe he had something in the microwave he's going to get out or something. It was fast. It looks like he just churned that baby out and, you know, stuff. So, and I, you know, it's like he's a painter. He's attacking the canvas. Get him away from it. You know, it's all crazy. But if you, there's this really good documentary. I don't know if you've ever seen it. And I just did that horrible artist thing to artists. Do you know when two artists are talking to each other, they start playing that little card collector game. It's like, so-and-so, do you know who he is? So-and-so, have you met him? Have you seen his work? If I say so-and-so, do you know who I'm talking about? It's like, and you just tell, and you do that to me, who has test phobia, I just start lying. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I got that. Isn't he the one that does the what? You know?
I don't do that at all. I don't know what you're talking about.
No. But that's the kind of the reason when I started doing the whole art history thing. It was like, don't embrace it as who you are. Don't like, oh, I'm not hot. I am hot. I'm everything. I'm just a mishmash. Can you put it in there? So, but there's this thing called Painter's Pain. It was done in 1973. Emilio and D'Antonio was the director. But it's a, they have... I almost said newsreel. How old am I? They have footage of de Kooning, Motherwell, like Hans Hofmann, Frank Stella, Warhol's in there too. It's on Netflix. Go and watch that movie. Because de Kooning, he is painting incredibly slow. So when you see this sweeping, you know, huge brushstroke on there that's just incredible. I mean, it's like this tiny, almost like the secondhand clicking on a watch. He's just moving his arm to make that arc. Did it. And all these years, I would look at this, I was like, oh, it's, you know, because it used to say action painting. It's action painting, you know, and I'm thinking like detectives or something. Action, got it. But no, it's just like, and it's very, you know, he's very focused on the whole process. So when people come out to my paintings, it always sort of stymied me. I was like, how could you think I could possibly paint that on that surface? But I realized the appearance of what a painting is, as it was opposed to the way it was actually produced, is not always so easily discerned, you know, when you're standing in front of it. And so, you know, part of that whole process of me just building those paintings with pure hue, chip by chip by chip by chip, was it allows, when you look at somebody who does Trump Lloyd or somebody who does these photorealistic paintings and stuff, if you look at it and you're like, oh, Vermeer, I can't see a brushstroke. I don't know. You're not aware of his process. You're aware of his image. You're aware of the subject, and you get pulled into it. So when you get painting, and that's why when I say the easel painters are the very painterly painters, when you get into this process, well, your process is part of it, but you balance, you know, you try to balance it enough where the subject matter is as compelling as the way it's produced, then you got something going. You know, then you got this sort of energy on there. And there's not a lot of folks who can really, you know, pull that off, you know, in the process of that.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, so when you look at, and these, my paintings have always been super tactile, you know, they've always been very sort of chunky, you know, when I used to do the collages and stuff, I was using real toys on the collages and putting, you know, gallons of stuff on top of it. But the whole idea is that the texture, which is really weird because I'm not a 3D person. I'm not a 3D person. In fact, when I was in graduate school, we used to call the sculptors the rednecks of the art department because they could really handle tools, you know, and we were like completely, you know, effete little painters. We had no idea. I was like, oh my God, you know, a sander, what the hell's that? You know, so, you know, it did that stuff. So anyway, so that's my process on there this week. Okay.
If there was one underlying theme to all your work, what do you think it would be?
Terror.
Terror.
Sheer unmitigated terror. Underlying theme to the process. Well, this is even weirder. So I'm going in there. I think I have it down. I know it. And I say to the gallery owner, I said, she goes, well, I said, well, I started out this whole process, you know, sort of this narrative. And I said, there's this couple over here and the title of the painting is Married Me and they're standing by the subway. And I'm not sure who's asking who to get married, but they're doing that. And then there's this, you know, this sort of grinder situation happening up in this painting where these two guys are meeting on the street. I'm like love and romance or something. And then I'm sort of like, it's that sophisticated. I was thinking it's sort of like British novelist. This is like all about romance and intrigue. I don't know where my head was. And so Kirsten, the guy only points to the holy confrontation. She goes, well, that one scares the hell out of me. That's not about love. I'll tell you that right now. And I was just like, well, okay. Not about love then. Okay. So I don't know. To me, it's like figures on ground. But then I did this weird thing where my husband came in to me, he goes, you need to paint stuff, because he's really good with art. You need to paint stuff that people want on their walls. And I'm like, well, what is that stuff, Dave? And he's like, I think you should do a landscape or a still life, because people like landscapes and still life. So I did this one where it's these my sort of effort at Mirandi, because I was looking at it, and these pots on the windowsill, and you look outside, and you can see the city scene behind it, because I couldn't decide if I wanted to do a landscape or a still life when I did it. And it's not huge. It's 24 by 24 inches, and it took just as long as all the other stuff. And I did it, and to me, it didn't have the, to me, the sort of the compelling image of, you know, a figure on ground, you know, and it was sort of the absence of figure. But then I started doing this weird stuff where, like, so I named the painting "On the Way to Brunch, He Glanced Out Her Window." And I was like, that painting got more people talking about it and stuff. Because I just put it on Instagram and I said, you know, here's this painting. Is it a still life? Is it a landscape or is it a walk of shame? Because it's this weird sort of thing, you know, because people go to brunch, but I'm not sure who's going to brunch. But then this sort of weird thing that kind of hit me. I was like, okay, what is the one thing? There's this one element that, like, every painting you've ever stood in front of, there's this one element that's consistent with everything. It's like the process is that painting, that thing was designed with that there's going to be a person standing in front of it looking at it. There's like, it's like this is as basic as you can get. You've got this one thing. So when people are standing there looking at a hopper and like, oh, that poor woman, she's so lonely looking out the window, you know, that God help her, you know, that kind of stuff. I was like, who are we really talking about here, hon? You know, it's like you're looking at the process. So when I'm doing like the still life, you're still doing a figure painting. You're doing sort of like the artifacts of that subject or whatever at that person. It's still, there's still a real narrative there between people or minimally the person looking at the process on it. So that's, so narratives, people, I don't know.
Whatever. Yeah. Yeah. I heard, I think it was an interview with Anish Kapoor, and he was going on about names, the names of things, that it's really important not to take it lightly. Yeah. Because he said something along the lines of the name, whatever you call it, is the context through which the person, the viewer, you know, sees it. So if you can change the whole dynamic of it by the name of it, which is kind of what you were saying there, just reminded me of it.
Yeah, that was naming something, because my husband's in publishing, and so there's this huge sort of thing about stories and biographies and narratives and titles and all these years we've been doing magazines and books and stuff. And so when I came back into painting, I started doing these, I call it this is a literary term, I'm not trying to be offensive, don't anybody write me angry stuff, but it's called the chick lit series. And because there's a term in publishing called chick literature, and it's this hip, you know, writing, but it's from a woman's point of view and this kind of stuff. And I kept on seeing these, quite a few of my paintings had this one sort of, there was a female figure that I was using, and she had this sort of story going on about it. And I'm like, this is kind of cool. I kind of manipulate this, you know, woman going through life in the city. And I thought, well, that'd be kind of the series. So I started calling it like the Chick Lit series, and then I do the title after it. And then, of course, then Dave comes in like, man, you better not do that. That's going to offend a lot of people. And I was like, well, I don't want to offend anybody. That's not my thing. So, but there's still like a super strong narrative with those, that where the title sort of kind of plays into that. And it places it, you know. So, and, you know, it's that weird thing. You look at your paintings and you're back at that time and you're remembering, you can almost remember like how bad your coffee was that day or something. It's just such a memory tag for a lot of stuff. So.
Well, number one, there's another hashtag for you to use to add to Instagram. and then the other thing just sparked in my mind there was, do you see much crossover in the kind of creative process between the process of writing and the process of making a painting for you?
All right, I'll ask you, what do you think? Do you think in words or do you think in images?
I think in images all the time.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't, but you see, do you talk to yourself?
Do I talk to myself? Oh, yeah, all the time. Yeah. But not out loud. But for me, words are more musical than, you know, I think in words in terms of rhythms, you know, like when I'm writing, if I can't think of the word, I'll just put blah, blah in the space that I know.
Yeah. Yeah,
that it should fit, you know, and then I'll come back and get it later kind of thing.
Yeah, no, because it's, you know, and I'm not big on the whole left brain, right brain stuff, but the painting is not, you know, we say narrative all the time, but that's not, it's not to me in the sense of story. I don't storytell. I don't illustrate a specific scene. I have nothing against that, but that's not what I do. Because to me, and the whole, I don't know how deep you want to go into this whole process, but when I was in graduate school, there was, what happened was, so I'm doing these huge mangas, collages, and these long, these big sort of pseudo-religious artworks where I'm building these narratives. And I was basing them on religious triptychs and how they would just sort of discover and bring out back parts of them that they could find, these artifacts from churches and whatnot. And I really liked the whole triptych presentation. So I was painting these intricate centerpieces, highly, as much as I could, rendered to look real, pretty much as good. And then I would do this sort of free form, intuitive, crazy, very of the moment painting using enamel and spray paint and toys and stuff to build up the paneling frames that would represent these pieces. Yeah. So I was all into at the time there was no internet. So I had family photo albums, I had bits of newspaper, I had all the collage materials and that was in vogue in the 70s or whatever. So I'm building all these pieces up. So I'm telling stories, but I'm not quite sure what the stories are. They're more dreamlike. I'm sort of building these pieces and I don't really trap myself in the stories. So I get into Syracuse based on these huge collage things. And Gary Trentel was there and Alex Katz was his teacher, and he's very much into rendering. His drawings were just incredibly beautiful and stuff. And so I think being one of the two figurative people in there, they were sort of banking on that I would continue doing this figurative stuff. So I roll along. I go into first semester, second semester. I sort of get into this weird situation where I am more focused on, all the minimalists are saying, dude, you need to get rid of your figures. It's all color and stuff. And they kept on questioning the whole process. And then I'm not quite sure to this day why I did this, but in the two semesters, you have that summer. And I cleared out my entire studio except for one table and a typewriter and a chair.
That's pretty minimal.
It was super minimal.
The minimalist got you.
And that's what I was doing. I was like, all right, you want me to get rid of everything, so it's just pure concept. So I had come through, it's early 80s or whatever. So conceptual art is just a paragraph on a piece of paper. It doesn't have a look except for the paragraph on the piece of paper, but that's not a look. Okay, never mind. Anyway, so you go through there, and I'm sitting down there. I'm like, I'm going to write the narrative. So I wrote this novel-length manuscript that summer about a angry artist sitting in his studio writing about, how the world didn't understand him and all this other stuff. Semi-autobiographical. So I had this manuscript, and my roommate, Julie Gaines, she has a store called Fish's Eddie in New York, but we were roommates. She is like Mrs. Energy, go get it done. And she said, can I read your manuscript? And I was like, sure, you can read mine. So she took my manuscript. She was studying, had a class with Tobias Wolf. She took the manuscript over to his house. She broke into his house and left the manuscript on his kitchen table with a note saying, you need to read this. Call the book. So he did. And I got into the graduate writing program while I'm in the painting program. And so now I have this weird dual track and the reason that all that happened was the writers never questioned the form. They were like, it's a novel, it's a short story, it's a poem. What are you doing with inside that? What is the story about that? So, and that's sort of the way I got into writing was, I was doing both of those. All this is going on, and the professors in painting are getting really nervous. They're like, you're not painting. I'm like, the typewriter. And they're like, no, that's not painting. So I go back and I so now I'm doing this super minimalist, silhouettes of women, primary colors, sand, hair, and they're furious. They're not liking it at all. This is not the highly rendered collage that you came in. Mr. Randler, what the hell are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. So there, at the time, there was a visiting professor there, and then Gary Trentel was there as the head, and they didn't know what to do. Because I was painting, but I was painting under what they expected me to do. Meanwhile, I'm over in the writing department, and I'm working away and yucking it up with people and stuff. And so they had what I later called like the faux Rembrandt committee, you know, where you have these guys who, like, if you think you have a Rembrandt in your museum and you're not sure, you'll call in these experts and they'll come and validate. And the weird thing is you want them to come in and validate for insurance purposes, but you don't want them to come in and invalidate it, because then all of a sudden your $1 million Rembrandt, you know, it's wallpaper. It ain't nothing. You know? So they're going to determine for you what is art. So Gary and Sharon Gold, both thinking that they're doing the good thing, I'm sure. I don't think they can remember, decided that they were going to have this evaluation about who was a mature artist and who wasn't. And they were going to review all the graduate students of like all graduate paintings of their work. And if you got through, you could move on to write your thesis. And if you didn't get through, you had to stay there another year under academic probation. So they got to me and bam, they hit me. It's like, Mr. Randler, you'll be spending another year with us under academic probation because your work is not art or whatever the term was. And I was like, this is bizarre, because I come undergrad up through VCU. Laurie Anderson was a visiting sculptor there. At VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University, the reason it works so well as an art school, it was like, go ahead, be a pluralist, try different things, move this over. You want to go try sculpture, go try it. You want to do fashion, bring the two together, have shows. I get to Syracuse University, it's all buttoned down. You know, it's all like painters paint, writers write. No, so I went, you know, I had tears. I threw stuff across my studio. I went and saw the chairman of the department, and he brings up my name. He said, what's your social security number? Because I'm explaining, like, oh, Gary Trento hates me, blah, blah. So I'm going all this stuff, and he brings up my name on this computer screen. He goes, Mr. Randler, you have a 4.0 with our department. He goes, we do not put our 4.0 students on academic probation. I don't understand what Mr. Trento is doing, but I think there's an apology in order here. And I was like, ah. So the next day I got called to Gary's office and he apologized. But he said with reservations about the writer thing. So that was sort of my weird, bitter, sweet, you know, blending of the trying to do both and moving into one and two in the narrative on the pieces. So when I come back and I'm doing painting versus writing kind of stuff, it's completely two different things, because when you get into the novel writing, you start doing magazine and all that stuff, it's a completely brain, you're doing it for completely two different reasons. And so when I'm doing a painting, I want, for one thing, you're in that whole process of creating and development of sort of the form, and you're not quite sure what you're doing. And the business of writing for fiction, there's a sort of this form that you're trying to communicate something. And if, you know, if you're doing it for publishing, for narrative, for promotions or advertising, you're trying to sell something, or there's sort of like the happy propaganda goes with, you know, capitalism. You're trying to promote that process or whatever. So it's a two different brain things. It is for me anyway. I can't say for everyone else on that, but.
Okay. There's another question from Instagram. It's from artist Brian Fox, and he asks, how does your extensive background in marketing, advertising, and publishing help you succeed in the fine arts gallery world?
That is a good question. Well, obviously, and people talk about this on the podcast all the time. They talk about branding and marketing and promoting and doing any, you know, obviously, like you and I've discussed, the process of technology has made sort of promoting your process a lot easier than it used to be. But the influence of, you know, that whole process of image versus content and promoting it through, you know, social media or magazine articles or whatever, that one person you had on here before, I can't think of her name. She was, you did the Christmas special with her.
Oh, yeah, Ashley Longshore.
Oh, my God. I don't know what coffee she drinks in the morning, but I want some of that stuff. I'm not going to lie to you. The reason I know that, Ashley, the reason I know her stuff is because husband and I are driving down from D.C. to the gallery, and I'm like, you need to listen to this. And so I played her Christmas interview. You know, did you ever see American Beauty with Annette Bening, where she's playing this real estate agent and she's listening to these empowerment tapes?
Yes.
That's how I use Ashley to get me into that long walk at the gallery. You know, I'm like, she's pull out your big girl panties. And then I'm like, I'm with you, Ashley. I'm with you. I'm like, she needs to do a TED talk, but I'm afraid they'd like bleep out half of her stuff. But she was so good. That kind of entrepreneurial push, a lot of, you know, that's what we were doing all those years with the magazine and publishing. And you need to do, I wouldn't say you can need to do to the empowerment level that Ashley reaches, which is like, you know, way out there. but you do, you know, obviously you need to be able to promote yourself. But, you know, to be fair, this is the sort of quandary I'm in, is that, you know, that all the gallery people say, do not do a blind submission. Do not approach a guy. We are not looking for artists. Come to our openings. Get to know our people. It's like, look, buddy, I'm in Washington, D.C. I can't get out to L.A. next week to your opening. I can't build this kind of relationship that you're expecting me to do. So I need to find ways to promote myself online, to get the word out there. Like, I'm looking for galleries in L.A. and New York. You know, I'm doing all this. How does one do that? But, you know, through self-promotion. And I think she has a handle on it like no other on there. So I was really impressed with her in that process.
Yeah, when you were talking about Andy Warhol and targeting people, and like, she's got a whole group of her market who she categorizes as trophy wives. And she'll tell them to their face, yeah, you're in my trophy wife group. And it's the same kind of thing. Like, she targets wealthy people who she knows has the money to buy, and then another market for her is the fashion industry, and she kind of allies some of her stuff with that. And it's very thought out.
But, and she's like Warhol in a way, because I think from the, and again, I'm, you know, limited to what I see online and stuff, but from what she's done, and then also the energy and the entrepreneur spirit that she has is who she is. I mean, that's her world. And she's really that kind of personality. And I'm not sure. I think you were talking to Adrian Stein. So you referenced another friend of hers, and they were talking about how Ashley was saying, you need to get yourself away from the gallery to do your own thing. But that's like more personality based. And a lot of artists, they don't have it. And they really are not supposed to have it. But yet, John, we're sort of artist shamed, because they'll say, you'll get around, you know, it's like, you need to do this. And you need, my husband, he'll walk in, it's like, you need to get on that Instagram and you need to get yourself out there. And it's like, I'm over here with orange, pink, and green, and this brush, and I'm trying to figure out how this stuff relates. My brain cannot deal with this at this point in time. Please step out of the studio. You know, it's just like, so I feel like a lot of folks' pain is like, I'm the same way. I want to do the right thing, John. But at the same time, it's like, I am no way Ashley Longshore. I'll never be her. As much as I want to be her, I cannot. I just don't have the energy to do that. So, and to be fair, you know, most folks are working a full-time job and they're probably painting, you know, and with every off moment they have. So, which is, you know, it's a way.
Okay. What are you working on at the moment that no one else knows about?
Well, there's commission talk going on, somewhat from the show. But that was another weird thing too. It's like, you're meeting people and they're like important people that I would need like 4 weeks to prepare to meet them, that you're the gallery owner is like yanking you by the back of your arm saying, you have to go meet these people, and they just dragged you over there. She'll be like, they just bought two of your works, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, and then you're on, you know, and I'm out there tap dancing as fast as I can, you know, like, yay. And they're really, you're so thrilled because somebody got it enough to buy your stuff. but I'm still mortified from having to deal with everybody's niceness coming at me from all angles. So I'm not quite sure how I'm sort of walking through that whole process of what is commissioned work. I've never done anything like that. You know, I didn't sell a painting until the other night. That was the first painting I ever sold in my life. So that was kind of a weird experience on there. It's just weird. I mean, and so what happens is I'm at the Jefferson Hotel, and because, you know, we're going to do it up if I'm going to go down to Richmond. So I go in the room and they have real flowers in the room, and they had this orchid in the room, and I was, you know, I'm all Gomer Pyle, like, oh, what, there's real flowers in this room, Dave. And he's like, for as much as we're paying for this room, it should be real flowers. I was like, good way to go, Dave. So the orchid was, I was fixated, and I think it was like pre-stress, like pre-gallery stress. So I'm like, so I'm taking pictures like a mad fiend on this, like, this orchid. It was just really pretty. So I had this painting up behind me that was just like from this room when I was in this with this orchid and stuff, and I'm not sure why I'm doing that. I can't tell you. It's just, it seems the right thing to do at the time, kind of process. The thing is, it's like, I know, and I've heard a lot of people talk about this, you know, it's like, I know that I should, and I feel like I'm sort of like, I'm doing this test phobia. I feel like I'm being shamed a little bit. Like, I should have a plan, but I don't have a plan beyond really the next painting, you know, because my whole point was I wanted just to paint to get back to it. And this whole other level of suddenly a year later, being in a gallery and then dealing with all that comes with that, and then the after show stuff, because it's still going on, is also new to me. And it's kind of going to, it's like, I don't want to get in the way of the painting. So I'm sure that's why I came home. It's like, I got to do another painting. Got to get another painting. Got to do a painting, you know, because yeah, process, yeah. You know, so.
Very good.
I don't know.
Okay, this is my last question. I ask this to everyone who comes on the podcast. If there's one thing you could pass on to future generations, what would it be?
That Ted Randler was a genius. That's like, and they would repeat that over and over again. Like, God, he was amazing. The only thing I can really say to that is, like, I think there's a difference between, I know, oh, that one artist you had on there, she totally stole my answer, which was, I was going to say, empathy. Was really mine, and I'm like, damn, she took it. I can't use it. But what? Because to me, that's what happened between like modernism and postmodernism. Like modernism, up until that point, was all like empathy and process. So it's like you become part of that, and then all of a sudden, postmodern, it became like irony and image. There's no more empathy. You don't feel, it's more ironic or sardonic kind of imagery that goes on through the whole process. The only thing I can say is like, I think that if there are painters and then there are artists who paint. And I think that sometimes people will look at painting and it's not always the best match for what they're doing. And I'm not saying they're not artists, but I'm saying that you need to sort of embrace painting for sort of the painting's sake. I know that's going to sound kind of real esoteric or whatever. But, you know, there are those folks who, get lost in the process of being a painter, and they don't really embrace painting for the, you know, painting is painting. It's not talking about painting. It's not looking on Instagram. It's not, you know, talking about it when you're drunk in a bar or something. It's painting. It's this whole event. And I think if you can get people to sort of empower themselves through that's probably a bad answer, but
no, I think it's good. It's quite an interesting, I hadn't heard that idea before, but say it again. There are artists who paint and there are painters. No, say it again.
There are painters who are painters. I mean, they embrace, yeah, the whole process, but then you'll see this all the time. You see there are artists who use paint. And then, you know, and the easy, I mean, you could go, let's go way up there where it's safe. Let's go beat up somebody that gets beat up all the time. The Koons guy. Jeff Koons, right?
Yeah.
It's so easy. I mean, and I'm, trust me, not a fan, but, you know, he uses paint. He's not a painter. And everybody gets all upset, like, oh, what is he doing? It's like, he's not a painter. he's not like a painter's painter. He's not somebody, he doesn't embrace painting for the sheer joy of the event and for what his discoveries you make in the process. He's using paint to make art so he can, you know, work with his market and do his whole little deal. And I think lots of times, maybe because painting is sort of held in this sort of high realm, or this, or was, I don't know if it still is, it's like this weird thing where people will glom onto it and they're doing horrible paintings. It's like, you know, don't pick up the brush, go walk away. And then, then you see the same person, but they're really good artists. You know, they're doing this incredible, they have these incredible thoughts. They just need to move into video, or they need to move into something, because they're expecting painting to solve something where it cannot. It's like, they're not, you know, it's that thing, like I was saying with the easel painters, they're just not embracing the form of painting. And I'm not even going to begin to say, I'm like, oh, I know what it's all about. But I'm just saying, from my perspective, this little guy in D.C. looking at paintings, a lot of them, is that there are a lot of folks who will say, I want to be a painter. I want to do artist, you know, art-like stuff. And it's the worst decision they can make. And I, you know, having gone through the faux Rembrandt committee, I'm not going to begin to tell anybody who is and isn't art. You know, certainly, I'm sure a lot of people told Van Gogh, you know, stick to preaching. You know, it's just like, you know, who's to say? But I think there's this weird sort of reverence that's given to paintings that as opposed to like people should, you know, it's one form or something. I don't know.
So what's an example of a painter who paints?
You want me to the whole list?
No, just because you gave the Jeff Koons one, which was great, very clear. What's the other side of it?
Yeah, well, we'll do history because it's easiest to do. Like, oh, okay. Marsden Hartley. Do you know this?
No, don't know.
I just put my card. See, I win, John.
You win. Yeah, everyone wins with me. It's really
Marsden
easy.
Marsden Hartley, why I like
No, tell me somebody I know so I know what you're talking about.
Oh, okay. Let's see. Well, you know Bonnard.
Yeah.
That's kind of an easy one. He's an easy one. Duncan Grant's another one. Francis Bacon. Any of the ones that sort of like...
Okay.
That they make... Alice Neal was a good one. She was good. It was like they sort of find themselves, and they also find this painting, this process, and it serves them. And they make discoveries through that process, and it expanded that way. So
yeah.
It's not.
Yeah, it sort of reminds me of what Vincent Desiderio was saying on the podcast about the technical narrative. He describes the technical narrative and the pictorial narrative or the dramatic narrative, but this thing of like just the paint and the way you paint and the reason you paint in the particular way says as much as the content of the picture.
Yeah, and you know, you're a painter yourself. You know the whole, it's like, you don't paint for the end result to hang it up in a gallery. You want that, you know, we can't even say adrenaline rush, the sort of meditative you, that sort of thing that you capture when you're in that process and you're in the, you know, the zone, for a 1960s term. But if you're in that zone and you're painting, you know, you're not thinking in words, you're not really thinking in images, you're sort of, and the closest I've ever gotten to it was, I'm horrible at sports, but at one point, I got into racquetball, and I kind of got good at it, because I wasn't, you know, I'm non-competitive, like, we're all friends, so I did this thing, but in racquetball, you're up against the ball. You know, like, you get that blue ball. And so if you get any kind of good at it, you get into this thing where you're not thinking, you're not trying to think about what you're about to do. You're reacting, and it becomes such a fluid, perfect moment where you connect with that ball hitting your racket, and it makes, you know, and you point off on a wall or something like that. If you go to the front, that moment of being where you're just in that moment, the pure existential, like, I don't give a shit about anything else. I'm going to hit that blue ball, and it's going to go where it's supposed to go. That is as close as I've come to being able to describe what it's like when you make a mark, one mark with your brush, it's the last mark, and you've nailed whatever it is that's been eating at you for the last 6 weeks, 8 weeks. And then you stand back, and you know, then the next day, it's like a bad relationship. You look at it, it's over. And you can't get back in that painting. And this is that weird thing that happens when you're painting. It's like you're so excited about doing it. You're into it. You got week three, you can't think of anything else about pink, blue, and orange. And you're getting that, and you're down. All right, week nine, it's like, oh my God, I've got work to do. This is working out. And then, you know, you get into week 18 or something, and you're like, golly, if I just want to see this thing completed. And then it didn't complete it. And then you're so depressed the next day because you can't get back into that mother. And you're just like, oh my God, it's over. I'm, you know. We were so good together. What happened? You know, it's just like there was a give and take. There was love. And so, and then, you know, that's why, like, the next, you know, like, you have a painting ready because you got to get back up on that. You know, it's a bad drug to have, but you got to get back up on that monkey and do it again. You know, it's just like that's, and that to me, it's like, you, so when people are standing there sipping wine in front of a gallery wall, they don't see, you know, the passion, the throes, the terror, the excitement, you know, with all that going on that goes on with just making those marks, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think they get something. Something's communicated.
Definitely. I hope so. Yeah. I hope so.
Yeah. Okay, what is the best website for people to get you on?
Randler.gallery. You don't need a .com, just my last name and then dot and then gallery.
Okay.
On YouTube.
I'll put a link in the show notes. You're also on Instagram. I'll put a link to that. I think you're on Facebook as well. I'll put a link to that.
I am.
Maybe you'll get one more follower, maybe two. I don't know. I can't say.
One or two would be wonderful.
Yeah. So I tell you, it's a lot to do with the hashtags you're using, but anyway.
That's true.
Okay. Well, look, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. It's so entertaining and lovely to get to know you a little bit better. I really like your work. As I say, as soon as I saw it, I knew I liked it. And then, yeah, the pointillism thing comes in. But then straight away, you get, you know, kind of look at it a bit closer, and it has got this aliveness to it. And then there's that other layer on top of it then of the names that you give the different things. That opens up a whole other, you know, a real look and another avenue of, I don't want to say narrative, but there's, you know, there's more going on there.
Yeah.
I really like the flatness, and I like the kind of graphic kind of quality to it. There's something very soothing. I find something very soothing about them. Whereas as I was saying about the Surratt, that kind of pointillism thing, I find there's something a little bit disturbing about those. Not soothing. There's something too still, where there's something soothing and easing. It's very hard to put in words what I feel when I'm looking at your paintings, but I get it. And I imagine looking at them in person would be completely different because they're, as you say, so textured. And I'm just like, your whole story is great. I mean, of course it's going to speak to me, but to you know, return to painting and to get right into it and to be so good is brilliant. So yeah, so thanks for all that, and thanks for your time.
This has been a thrill. I've been looking forward to this for weeks or days, whatever.
Okay, well, I'm sure we'll be in touch again. We'll keep in touch, but for now, we'll say goodbye.
All right, sir. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
All right. Bye, Dom.
Okay, well, bye. Remember to go to the Gently Does It Patreon page. Go to patreon.com/JohnDaltonGentlyDoesIt and join the conversation.
I've never felt this good in my entire life. Make me some spaghetti. Yeah, we are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. We're better than you thought, but not as good as we think. We are the Argyle.